Thank you for directing your internet connection to the sermon audio page for Christ Orthodox Presbyterian Church. You can learn more about Christ OPC by visiting our website at www.christopcatl.org. Christ OPC meets for worship each Sunday at 11 a.m. and 5:30 p.m.
So today we're looking at Exodus chapter 3, beginning of verse 7. And about 3 months ago, I had the opportunity to preach to you from Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. And I don't know if I'm allowed to call it a series if I preached the previous passage 3 months before, but we're looking at the next one today. So the passage before this one was that big moment in Exodus where God finally appears to Moses in that what we call the unburning bush, because that's the point, that the fire was in the bush and wasn't consuming it. And God called to Moses from out of the bush. Moses came, the shoes come off, and then God begins to speak. And what we're going to see in our passage is what God says. What was the message that God descended into the bush to give to Moses and then eventually through Moses to his people, Israel? Exodus chapter 3, beginning at verse 7. This is the word of the Lord. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, But I will be with you. And this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. By the time we come to this passage, Israel has already been suffering for a long time in Egypt. It's hard to even get a sense of the scale of just how long that has been. We're not talking about years. We're not talking about decades. We're talking about generations, plural. So that suffering and abuse and lifelong trauma is all they've known, all they can remember, and all that their past descendants could remember as well. This is long-term suffering. And it's the kind of suffering that we, as I find, as Western believers, we struggle to know what to do with this kind of suffering. We're the kind of people who, when a problem comes, we like to look for a solution. And so when somebody is sick, we look for something we can do that's going to help, that's going to make their situation better. And so, okay, I'm going to make you a casserole, or I'm going to put you on the prayer list, or I'm going to say some kind of encouraging word. I'm going to do something that's going to help. And if the suffering is something I'm experiencing, if I'm sick, I go to a doctor. I look for medication. I see if there is a procedure, some kind of treatment to remove the sickness from me. We have this deep-seated belief, this deeply ingrained instinct. We believe that if I will just work hard enough, if I'll just look diligently, there is a solution out there to whatever I am experiencing, whatever I'm facing. There's a fix for that problem. If I just look hard enough, I will land on it. And then you get an illness for which there is no treatment. Then you get a chronic condition that can only be managed. And perhaps there's palliative care. Perhaps not. As believers, we struggle with this. We struggle to know what to do with suffering that doesn't lift, the suffering that goes long. As Western believers, we can also struggle with the other side of this when we see someone else who is suffering and they're going through something that doesn't have a quick or simple fix. They've got the chronic illness, or maybe they've got a struggle with sin, with some desire that just doesn't go away, and they're wrestling with it and they're doing everything they can to turn from it. Still, the desire's there. We want to help. And yet in that kind of situation where the suffering or the struggle goes on for years or decade or decades, and we're still walking along with them, we find it can make us uncomfortable because we want to do something to make it better. But what can I do? We might find ourselves sometimes looking for something to say to fix it, but what can you say? And so we come up with empty platitudes. Or we look for some suggestion that we can give. We make the offer, hey, I read about a supplement on a blog post online. Have you tried this? Hoping against hope, this is going to fix it. Here's a solution to your 10-year chronic illness. We want to believe there's something that can fix it, and that's a good desire. But we find that we do not have the power to do so. And suddenly, none of our instincts help us anymore. A meal might not be the help that they need. Putting them on the prayer list may not be the help they need. You should ask them. And asking them again and again, how are you feeling, may not be the help that they need. So what do you do when somebody's suffering long? In our passage, what we see is God speaking in response to Israel having suffered for generations. We see him saying things that actually help. And then we see him promising to do something that will bring real, concrete help. And while some of this is only helpful because it comes from God's lips, we will also find some things that will be instructive for us as models for how we can help those or ourselves as we suffer long as well. So we'll jump into this. God starts speaking in verse 7, and here's the beginning of his message. There are three verbs in here. He says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. That's where he starts. And it's interesting that when God sees their affliction, he does not start with the fix, although he's God and he could. He doesn't start there. He starts with these words that talk more about understanding. That word for seen, I've seen their affliction. It's an experiential word. It's saying that God has taken notice of what they're going through. I've seen it. Even apart from them saying anything, it's so egregious, and they're so filling my thoughts that I've been looking and I see it. I'm aware of what they're going through. That's the first. The second says, and I have heard their cry. That's an even stronger verb in this context. To hear someone's cry brings to mind something like a mother that hears her child stumble and fall. And maybe for a moment she was looking elsewhere, but then she hears that cry that could only be her child. And all of a sudden, all the noise that's around her, it's as though it vanishes. And she can only hear this one sound. It arrests her attention. God says, I've heard their cry. I've noticed what they're going through. And when they began to cry out to me, it's as though it was the only thing that was filling my awareness. I'm so focused on what they're going through. And then he gives this big one as the third. I know their sufferings. The Hebrew word for know is also an experiential word. To know something in this sense is not just to be able to repeat the bullet points accurately. It's a personal knowledge. This is such a personal word that you even see it used in other ways, such as Adam knew his wife Eve. It's an intimate, personal, experiential knowledge. And God is saying here, I know not just the facts of your sufferings, I know it. I know what it's been like. I know how hard it is for you. I know the shame it brings. I know the discouragement you feel. I know everything about what you're going through. From an experiential standpoint, even, God says, I know. I know what you're going through. I know what it's like. And it is arresting my attention as though there's nothing else happening in the moment. Three verbs. Now, if we had been going through this as a true series, A while back, we would have hit Exodus chapter 2. The very end of that chapter is where we finally see God introduced as an active person in the book of Exodus. And when he's introduced, you find a verse that sounds very similar to the one we just read, where it says, "And God," in chapter 2, "God heard their groaning, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." Same three verbs. God repeats it in our passage, only with a little more detail. Now it's not just "God heard their groaning," but "I've seen the affliction of my people." Or he says, not just that he saw the people of Israel, but he saw the affliction. Not just that he heard their groaning, but it says he heard their cry because of their taskmasters. And before it was just "and God knew," but now he's expanded on it and he says, "I know their sufferings." Same three experiential verbs, only now much more so. It's as though God is drawing closer and closer to his people. And the closer he gets to them, the more laser focused he is on them, the more he feels the weight of their suffering themselves, the more it arrests his attention. God comes close and he says, "I'm not less affected by these things, Moses. The closer I get, the more affected I am." There's a movement. There's a progression. The closer God comes, the more compassion he feels, the more empathy he feels towards his people, as though he himself is somehow experiencing what they're going through, as though he can say to them, "Really, I understand," almost as though he's gone through it himself. We'll get to that in a few minutes. The closer he gets, the more empathy he feels. And think for just a minute what this means for us as believers in Jesus. How close has that fiery God come? For Moses, he was there in the bush right there, and Moses came so close he had to take off his shoes. Later on, Israel, you could say, came closer still as they came to the mountain and the same fire descended, and it said they could even feel the heat of it like a kiln on their faces. If you're a believer in Jesus, he's come still closer. You see that happen in Acts chapter 2 when the Spirit is poured out. And the sign of this happening is a flame coming to rest on their heads, an indication that this fiery God's presence has come to dwell in us. The closer he comes, the more focused he is on your suffering, the more he feels it with you, the more he groans with you and says, "I understand, I know what you're going through, I take it as seriously as you do." What God does first when he sees your suffering, he sits in it with you. He feels the pain of it every bit as much as you and I do. It even says in Romans chapter 8 that the Spirit in us groans. And when we can't come up with words to express the suffering, he does, because he so understands what you're enduring. This is his first response to your chronic illness. This is his first response to that sinful struggle that causes you such suffering, because you do wrestle with it and the desire is still there and won't go away. His first response is to draw near, to acknowledge the pain, to let it fill his sights, and to say to you as no one else can, "I really understand. I know what you're going through. I take it every bit as seriously as you do." That's the first thing God does. He draws near, and he has empathy with us as only he can. The second thing he does, though, we see in verse 8, where God not only says, "I understand what you're going through," but here says, "and I'm going to fix it." In verse 8, he says, "And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites." God says, "I'm not only moved by what you're going through, I'm not only going to sit with you in it and give you the comfort of my presence, I'm also going to fix it. I'm going to make it better." And this is exactly what we long to hear. We want to hear that this time the doctor is going to have a diagnosis that really will make that condition go away. There's a new medication, we've discovered something, and it's treatable, and you're going to be fine. We want to believe it can just get better. This is what's so often behind our intended helpful suggestions to other people. Have you tried this? Have you talked to so-and-so? Have you done this? We want to believe there's a fix. The problem is that when we try to give the fix, we make the mistake of forgetting that we're not God. And we don't have the power to fix their chronic condition, to fix their sin struggle, to fix that difficult relationship that just won't get better no matter how much they pursue Christ in it. We're not God. We can't fix it. But in this passage, what we see is that He is. And He says, I'm not only going to sit with you in this suffering, I'm going to make this right. And for Israel, He gets very specific in what He's going to do. He says, I'm going to bring you out from the Egyptians, out of slavery, out of infanticide, out of lifelong trauma that just goes on and on. I'm going to take you out of there and I'm going to bring you to this other place that I've prepared. And he starts to describe it as the first time. You've heard the phrases, you know, the land flowing with milk and honey. At this point, they hadn't. Here it is. He's describing it to them. He says it's filled with everything you need to flourish. And then he gives that list of nations. That's the point we tend to kind of gloss over because we're like, I don't know who the Jebusites are, but I guess it was important. The important thing to notice here is how many nations are in that place right now. There's six nations, six in that place right now. How many nations are going to replace them? Just one. This is a land that's suitable, that can fit six nations. God says, I'm going to wipe it clean. It's yours. I'm giving you a place so broad and so expansive and so flowing with milk and honey that it could satisfy all of them. I'm going to give it to you. Okay, this is how completely I'm going to fix your slavery situation. I'm bringing you out of Egypt. I'm bringing you to this place. And that's what he says. And again, for us as believers in Jesus, this is also something that is true of us. God is not just going to sit with you in your chronic condition. He is also going to fix it. The day is coming when Jesus will fix your chronic illness. Your pain will be gone. You may have forgotten what it is like to not experience the headache, the joint pain, whatever it is going on in your body. The day is coming when you will. The day is coming when you will look down and will be shocked to see that sinful inclination you have always had, it's just gone. Not there anymore. When Jesus returns, the dead will be raised, not as they were, but transformed. All things will be made new, including you and your body and your heart. This is not metaphor. Jesus is going to do this. He said, I will fix your physical pain. I will fix your broken relationship. I will fix you even in the depths of your heart. God says, I will sit with you in your suffering and I will make it right. And because God himself is the one saying it, not one of us giving some kind of platitude saying, I'm sure it's going to be fine. Or have you tried this? It's God speaking. The only one who can make your suffering right has said that he will. So 2 Corinthians 4 says, for this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. God draws near. He sits with Moses in the suffering and says, that's what I'm doing with Israel too. He also says, and I'm going to fix it. I'm going to make it better. And then when we come to verse 10, he begins to tell Moses just how he's going to do that. What's his plan? How's he going to get his people out of Egypt into this amazing fit for six nations place? Here's his plan in verse 10. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. God says, here's my plan, Moses. It's you. I'm sending you, because you remember at this point, Moses was in Midian with his father-in-law, Jethro. He's raising his sheep. He's built his new life for himself. He's got a wife there. He's got kids. God says, I know you've been in Midian 40 years now, and life is pretty good. You're going back to Egypt, and through you, all my people are going to come out. If you remember much about the book of Exodus, you know that many years ago, 40 years before these events, that this was exactly what Moses had wanted. When he was still in Pharaoh's household and he stumbled on that Egyptian that was beating the Israelite slave, and he decided, I've got to fix this. And he jumped in and he murdered that Egyptian. He was ready. I'm going to lead them out. I'm going to deliver them. I'm going to be God's agent. But then 40 years passed. 40 years of him developing a different kind of life. He started to like it, started to feel comfortable there, started to be content with this family he's got and the sheep he's got and the promise of eventually taking over Jethro's agricultural business. And so now God says, it's about to happen, Moses, what you always wanted. I'm sending you back. You're going to bring them out. Now Moses suddenly isn't so sure. He says, hold on a minute. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? This is the first of three objections in this conversation. This ought to have been a short conversation, but Moses keeps making objections, and then God responds over and over again, and suddenly you realize you're two chapters deep into this thing because Moses won't stop saying no. At first, with this first one, it seems like Moses is being kind of humble. Surely I'm not the right person. I'm not gifted enough. Surely there are more spiritual people out there. You should find someone more well-suited. But as his objections go on, deeper into this book, you start to realize that what's really going on here isn't so much humility. It's really just Moses saying, you know, I really don't want to. Could you send someone else, please? He finally says. Moses didn't want to go back to Egypt, because what's in Egypt? Suffering. Infanticide, slavery, murder, brutality, everything that he had escaped, everything that Israel is going through. We got this great contrast happening where you've got God who sees their affliction. His ears are arrested by their cry. He knows what they're going through. It's like he feels it in his own person. And you've got Moses saying, I think I'm fine over here. Moses sees it and says, well, that's a shame. I'm going to turn my thoughts somewhere else. Moses didn't want to suffer. God tells him, you're going to anyway. Moses is about to re-enter back into all that stuff that Israel was going through. Here you have Moses. He's going to suffer just like they are. But Moses, at least at this point, is not suffering well. He's not suffering with a godly perspective. He's not trusting God in the midst of it. Not yet. Moses just doesn't want it to happen, and yet it's happening. And that's what makes this promise applied to Moses so important to hear. When God replies to him in verse 12, this is his response to Moses. But I will be with you. All right, that first response to Israel and their suffering. I see what you're going through. I hear it. It arrests me. I sit with you in it as though it's happening to me. I'm with you in it. He says the same thing to Moses now. And here's the punchline for this point. That presence of God, the comforting presence, God taking your suffering as seriously as though it was happening to him, that doesn't only apply when you suffer well. If you are in Christ, it applies to all of it. To those moments that you have incredible perspective, just given to you by the Spirit, and you're praising God in the midst of your pain. This also applies to those moments when you respond less well. You're irritable. You're snapping at people. You're filled with self-pity. You are angry at him, at yourself, at anyone that comes near you. Even in that moment, God says, I will be with you in your suffering. It will fill my sights, and I will groan alongside you, whether you respond to it well or not. His compassion does not depend on how well you're performing in your suffering. He has compassion because he has compassion. He has mercy on you because he has mercy on you. And he has said, I will be with you in all the suffering that you are experiencing. This is something that we so desire. It is deeply worked into us by God. There are types of suffering that, in my experience, tend to draw it out more than others. One particular type that I have personally seen more than once draw out this impulse is cancer. And if this is overly personal for anyone, I apologize ahead of time. But I have seen it in particular as women experience breast cancer. There's something about that particular kind that's extremely personal. I find that some women even feel a little hesitant to share the details publicly. They may tell people that they're going through a procedure, but maybe not everything about it. And it's as though there are other women that have this radar. They just kind of hear certain phrases and know that's a woman that's going through breast cancer treatment. And this, what I've heard from more than one woman experiencing this, is how surprised they were to begin to hear from other ladies that they didn't know had gone through it too, but had. They start coming out of the woodwork. They start saying to them, not here's a fix, because they've been through it and they know they don't have that to offer. But they tell them, I went through this and I know what it's like. And it was okay in the end. Maybe because they knew, having gone through it themselves, that what helped so much in the moment was just one person that truly understood, not understood from a factual sense, but as though they themselves had gone through it and could say, I know what you're going through. And if you need someone to just come sit with you, I would be privileged to do that. That's a help. There really isn't any other replacement for it. It's a help that comes through someone who has experienced the suffering that you're experiencing. And that's why it's so important that the person that God sends to deliver this message to us is ultimately not Moses, but someone much better than Moses, the greater Moses, Jesus, who was tempted in every way that we are tempted, Jesus, whose body was broken, who experienced every bit of suffering this world had to throw at him in his human nature. He experienced it. Jesus experienced things like hunger. He experienced things like pain. And his human nature, he experienced, if you go to Gethsemane, even experiences like anxiety and distress and feeling overwhelmed. He experienced rejection, loneliness. Anything that you could endure in this world, he endured. He experienced all of it, so that he could be a merciful and faithful high priest. So that when he would come and sit with you in it, it would not be some distant Jesus who gives you pious platitudes, but someone who has gone through it. He knows what it's like to grieve loss. He knows what it's like to feel pain. He knows what it's like to feel alone with no prospect and the immediate future of that changing. And he comes and sits with you in it. He says, I've seen what you're going through. I've heard your cry because of it. I know what you're experiencing. And he's also the one that says, and I will bring you out. We know that he can. We know that he will, because he himself has come out of those sufferings through his own death and his own resurrection, and he will apply the very same to us. This is God's response to your suffering, believer in Jesus. Whether you suffer well or you suffer poorly, or likely some mixture of the two, his first response is not the fix. It's to come and draw near to you in it, to give you the gift of his presence in a way you really couldn't have it otherwise, because you get to know him, to share with him in his sufferings as he shares with you in yours. But he also says this: your body will not always hurt. Your relationships will not always be strained. Your heart will not always be corrupted by sinful desires you didn't ask for, but there they are. He will fix this. He will bring you out into a broad land that He has prepared for you. Will you please pray with me? Father, you say things to us that if it was anyone else, we wouldn't believe them. But these are your words. You say that you will bring us out. You say that you will fix this. You say that you come so close that you groan within us so that we can never suffer alone again. Father, would you give us this comfort? Make it real, especially to anyone here that is experiencing real chronic suffering. Father, would you also make us more skilled at comforting those who are going through these experiences? Father, would you give us the courage to sit with them in it, to give them our presence and not a solution, and instead to trust you to be the one to make this right? Father, we trust that you will do this. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.